Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Bennington, Vermont. This talk, delivered on Sunday, February 2, 2025, is by Naomi Miller on the topic of religious language as a transitional phenomenon.
I'm talking about religious and ritual language, and this is... I was thinking of it a little bit as a prelude to the conversation we're going to have, I think it's 2 weeks from now, about religious language, right? And I realized that I had co-authored a paper 32 years ago about religious language as a transitional object, which is a sort of familiar phrase in psychology that refers essentially to teddy bears, blankies, and other such objects that children become very attached to, right? And that serves a function for them that I'm going to talk about, okay? So I adapted this quickly from that paper. In the field of psychology, like in our culture, particularly now, I'd say, we tend to make false distinctions between intimacy and autonomy, between relatedness and interdependence, much like what Julie was reading from Gunn. Seeing the world this way makes it very hard to understand how people take risks, how people move forward in the face of adversity, and how people simply act like responsible adults in moments of intense conflict. And this is something I think we're all worrying a lot about now. Right? How are we going to manage to face this moment? So I looked back at this paper, which is about ritual language as an example of how human development is in fact made possible by the intersection of intimacy and autonomy, rather than by there being two separate things. And of course, psychology, very much like our culture in general, has tended to think of intimacy and dependence as something that is childlike and associated with the feminine and is supposed to be outgrown in the course of development, right? So the ideal adult, read male, is autonomous, independent, has no sense of dependency, no need for dependency. But in fact, psychology shows what we all know to be true, that the two things are themselves interdependent ongoingly throughout life, that you need to be able to access intimacy in order to be autonomous, and you need to be able to be autonomous in order to be actually intimate. Right. So when my friend Sarah Carl and I got interested in how religious language did this, we did what academic social scientists do, right? We went around interviewing people, and then we wrote a paper and we published it. And then that was our fun. What I'm going to do is talk particularly about little splices of the interviews we did with people. We talked to Quakers, to Catholics, and we looked at the language in the American Civil Rights Movement. Those were the three areas that we focused on. So I'm going to step back a minute now and talk about the pediatrician and child psychoanalyst D.W. Winnicott. Anybody ever heard of Winnicott? A couple of people. He coined the phrase transitional object, which I mentioned before, to describe the things that children imbue with comforting properties, things that, when they're holding them, allow them to fall asleep or go off to school or be left alone in a strange situation. Right? He wrote that these things are a symbol of the union of the baby and the mother. The object symbolizes the union of two now separate things, baby and mother, at the point in time and space of initiation of their state of separateness. Got it? These objects make possible what he called transitional relatedness, which is an experience that he described as a separation that is not a separation, but a form of union. So that sense of being related to somebody by being separate from them and being separate from them by being related to them, right? The object makes it possible for the child to feel connected in intimacy in a way that allows the child to do something scary alone. Now, as we all know, the need for this does not end in childhood. Yeah? So adults have multiple transitional objects. Wedding rings, magic bracelets from childhood. We all have a lot of them, right? And our connections to these objects, they're not rational at all. But they do the trick. And that's why we use them. They really do keep us feeling connected to something that allows us to brave scary things. I wear this when I'm driving in the snow, for example. And they work even when we don't know exactly what the something is that we're feeling connected to by the object. Ritual language works this way too, especially when it's good ritual language. Linguistic anthropologists have shown that a combination of prosody and meaning is what constructs the power of ritual language. I think we all know that from poetry as well. And what our interviews exemplified is how ritual language that makes a grown-up feel the way the right teddy bear makes a toddler feel is language that helps us move forward in the face of adversity. Of course, life is full of adversity. So, I'm going to first talk about the Catholic confessional briefly, then the Quaker silent meeting, expectant waiting, and revelation, and then the inspirational speeches of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, right? In the traditional Catholic confessional ritual, there's a repetitive form of language framing the naming of specific sins, yes? There's ritual language at the beginning of talking about your sins, and then there's a ritual phrase at the end. This language seems to serve two functions. First, it serves the function of restoring a sense of relationship with a parental figure, God, I guess, for Catholics, after a feeling of having jeopardized the relationship by sinning. Right? And then second is the transitional phenomenon, kind of function, of familiar words framing new behavior, the experience of speaking about a new internal conflictual experience, that is to say, a sin, which is sort of by definition conflictual. The words that frame the sins are said every time a confession is made. It starts with, "Forgive me, Father, for I have sinned," and it ends with, "You are forgiven, my child." Yeah. The meaning of the parishioner's opening prayer was described by one woman we talked to as the familiar words set into that soothing silence and darkness are like opening the door to a conversation with God. Mm-hmm. A young man put it differently, but very young man-like. "You know you're starting off on the right foot You make your intentions clear. You start off right by saying, first off, that you're really sorry. And another woman said what I thought of as kind of the deepest thing of all of them. She said, I find it comforting to start out on familiar ground, because once you start in on the sins, you never know quite what's going to happen. So these descriptions point to the way in which ritual words allow a depth of experience, and particularly a taking of risks, in relation both to oneself and to moral dilemmas that might be shared with others. The closing words of absolution, "You are forgiven, my child," can be seen as solidifying that transitional relatedness that Winnicott described, that creating a separation that is not a separation but a form of union. One young man said, I never really feel absolved of a sin unless I hear those words, "You are forgiven." A woman said, the words help me connect to something larger than just the priest, who's just a person. So it gives me courage to face my sins and maybe to change things sometimes. And one woman described it this way. She said, when I hear that I'm forgiven in those old, familiar words, it reminds me of my childhood and all the other times I've sinned and been absolved. And it always reminds me that being good is no easy task. It can take your whole life to learn. The Quakers are interesting in regards to language. The structure of a Quaker meeting is an example of language's transitional relatedness, because the Quaker practice is directly, intentionally, consciously framed in terms of accessing a sense of merger, specifically in order to then move forward into a more deeply committed way of life. The Quaker tradition is so focused on helping people form intentions that turn into actions about immediate social dilemmas. In the silent meeting for worship, there are practices that allow the participants to move out of a personal space and into a communal one. These include a kind of silence that's called expectant waiting. Every meeting begins with a period of centering silence, during which all present try to open themselves to hear divine messages and put aside preconceived ideas. What's experienced functionally is often deep communal meditation. From this merged communion of meditation can come words from any participant, which are heard by definition of the context, as revelatory. These words help people move forward in their spiritual development and in their social development as well. It's common for these messages to have implications for the management of current problems of social injustice of various kinds. So although it's not planned language, these spontaneous revelations, and it's not in the form of rhetoric, and it's not authoritative, this is a form of religious language that, like the Catholic confessional, springs from an experience of pre-linguistic sharing, that silent communal sitting, and then uses that experience to draw people into the process of very adult moral decision making. So it helps people go back into what could be thought of more of as an infantile experience, right? Quietness in the presence of others, in the function of helping people move forward into really taking on complex adult tasks of social responsibility. For Quakers, this language of revelation actually exists in a transitional space and evolves from transitional relatedness, as Winnicott would have defined it. The separation is not a separation, but a form of union. We do that here every week. In Quaker practice, the premise of continuing revelation is an integral part of a dialectic that's clearly spoken in Quaker theory, a dialectic between merger and autonomy, between silence and speech. This dialectic is seen as a safeguard against the development of overbearing autonomy, that is, the dominance of one person in a group who might claim to have more access to truth than everybody else does. And like other forms of religious language, it fosters adult moral decision-making and risk-taking exactly by providing access to a sense of interdependence. Like so many other movements for justice, the civil rights movement of the 1960s in this country required enormous individual and communal growth very quickly. Its accomplishments were achieved through many kinds of political action, by inspired leadership, and by countless acts of personal courage by individuals. Many social justice movements have religious bases, and many rely heavily on shared song to maintain courage and solidarity. But the civil rights movement here had both, and they blended with each other for a particularly powerful example of the use of religious ritual language to create transitional relatedness. To be reminded of the power of the words and song in that movement, I recommend watching or rewatching the documentary Eyes on the Prize. Did any of you see that? It's still available, you know, it's such a moving documentary. Eyes on the Prize. One of the really moving events depicted there is that 1963 Children's Crusade in Birmingham, which is this, over 1,500 children were arrested in 2 days. They boycotted school. They all went to a church in the morning, and from there they marched out in groups of 50 at a time, got arrested, another 50 came, got arrested, right? And they were taken off in paddy wagons and school buses. And of course, they sang as they were being arrested, and they sang as they were being taken away in the paddy wagons. And many of the things they sang were the adapted hymns for that moment that we're all familiar with. And one of them that's depicted is, I'm not going to try to sing it, of course, but part of the words were, "I'm on my way to freedom land. I asked my mother to go with me to freedom land. If my mother won't go, I'll go alone. I'm on my way to freedom land." I mean, could there be a more exact example of religious language as a transitional object? As one psychologist said, Furman, about the relation between intimacy and autonomy in childhood, he said, "Mothers have to be there to be left." And you know, those children's mothers were there. But they weren't there. And the song brought them there and enabled those kids to do that. Obviously, it's really a cheap shot, always, to quote from the speeches of Dr. King. But I'm going to do it, right? I'm going to explore just a little the keynote address he gave at the 1963 March on Washington for Civil Rights. And remember, he was speaking largely to people who were upending their lives and risking their lives and who had traveled to Washington from the movement, right? They had taken a few days off. And he offered them not just a dream, a hope for the future, but he offered them very immediate experience of soothing, of home, through the prosodic elements of rhythm and repetition in that speech. He spoke them a lullaby, as they say. He offered the stability of verbal images of home while using a rhythmic style that evoked the African-American churches of their childhoods. And in doing this, he coaxed people to venture further in a risky undertaking. He gave them courage by taking them home, courage to move forward by going home to comfort. First, he evoked the challenges and anger of very current events. He said, "You have come fresh from narrow jail cells, battered by the storms of persecution and staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive." And then he followed this with a kind of lullaby of home. "Go back to Mississippi, go back to Alabama, go back to South Carolina, go back to Georgia, go back to Louisiana." And then the next push. "Go back to the slums and ghettos of the northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed." And then this was followed by a great example of a verbal transitional object, the famous phrase, "I have a dream." This phrase evoked both a dream of the future and the staying power of a tradition, the American dream. The repetitive use of the phrase soothed and exhorted simultaneously. And in the final words of the speech, we see the essential quality of transitional phenomena, blending comfort with courage, regression with progression. He challenged people to do something new. He said, "Black and white, Jews and Gentiles, Catholics and Protestants must be able to join hands." And then he ended with the comforting familiar words of an old spiritual, "Thank God Almighty, we're free at last." This is a sort of one way of understanding why that famous speech worked so well, became so famous, is something everybody goes back to. That it was working as a transitional object should, as religious language and ritual language should, to take us home, help us feel our interdependence, not just for the sake of that, but so that we can move forward into unknown actions, sometimes very much alone. So that's my take on religious language.